At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Luke Guerrero stands ready to take your finance and investment questions and share his unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors. I'm Luke Guerrero, and I would like to welcome you back to another week here at InvestTalk. I certainly had a relaxing and resting weekend, and I hope that you also had a restful and relaxing weekend, and you're ready to start this week, which is, albeit, I want to remind you, a short week in the markets. We do have Wednesday off. We will not be doing a live show on Wednesday because it is a market holiday as we take all of those days off. And so I'm excited to give all I can to the next 4 days of this week. And in order to do that, I hope to hear from you live anytime over the next hour at 888-99-CHART and hear about what you want to talk about, because you are the most important part of this show and you drive the conversation forward. Now, hopefully, aside from hearing from you, we'll talk about some interesting stories that I saw today. We're going to have a focus, I think, on China, really, today, as well as touch on some other topics that I didn't get to last week. But all that happens, as well as the market rundown, after we get to our first caller question now.
Hey, guys. I want to get your evaluation of a company whose stock popped up on a screener. It looks cheap to me, and it looks like there are earnings that are expected to grow going forward. And that company is, I'm not sure how to say it, Autoliv, I think. And the ticker is ALV, and that's Alpha Lima Victor. Thank you much.
Autoliv sounds right to me. As you mentioned, the ticker is ALV, and it is a holding company that engages in the development and manufacturing of automotive safety systems. So the revenue is derived essentially from two things. Their seatbelt division makes up about 33% of the revenue, and the other 67% comes from their airbag steering wheel safety division. Now, looking at its relative strength over the past 5 years, it's kind of been up and down. I think their return over the past 5 years is just over 100%. In the past year, it's returned about 27%. And because it's a automotive supply parts company, I think the first thing we want to look at here is geographically, where does its revenue come from? And so about 20% of it comes from China, which, honestly, for some companies that derive so much revenue from China, it concerns me a little bit because of geopolitical tensions. But I think that given what this company does and the advantage China has right now in selling cheaper EV cars, especially to a lot of parts of Asia, it doesn't concern me that much. Now, the U.S. revenue is 22%. It's pretty well diversified. If you can see, if you're watching at home on the InvestTalk YouTube channel, you can see it's pretty well diversified across continents, across countries. So that's a good thing. So what has that meant for its sales growth? Well, in 2018, about $8.6 billion in revenue, projected to be $11 billion in revenue this year. That's about a 4% annualized year-over-year growth rate. Pretty solid. What does that mean for the bottom line? Great improvements from 4.3% in net margin to about 4.7% this year, projected to be 7.1% this upcoming year. They've been buying back shares pretty consistently over the past year. Their cash flow is improving. Their profitability is improving. They got a modest amount of debt, about $2 billion on a $9 billion market cap company. The dividend yield is about 2.4%. It's kind of been all over the place over the years as the price has fluctuated. They actually didn't pay a dividend for 1 year in 2020. But other than that, they've been paying a dividend that is, I would say, not consistent. But they've been buying back shares, so that certainly changes the dividend per share number as well. Now, looking into this company, I also saw that they had some insiders sell shares, which is something you may want to consider when you're looking at a company if insiders are selling a large amount of shares. In this case, not that much, nothing to be concerned about. Overall, from profitability and cash flow from their balance sheet, it looks like a pretty decent company. It's been pretty strong over this past year. And year to date, it's been pretty flat, however. But from a relative valuation perspective, pretty modest. Price to book about 3.7. averaging 3.2 year over year. Price to earnings about 10.2. I think it's a fine company. I think their revenue is diversified, which is good. I think one thing that concerns me, however, is not a lot of sales growth in the past 2 years. And so a lot of that has really been focused, except for the past year, not a lot of revenue growth. So it is projected to have a little bit this year. Growth seems to be drying up a little bit. As I said before, I'm not as concerned about the China exposure here, just given the line of businesses that it's in. But certainly, there have been some issues in rising trade tensions. So given kind of uncertainty around that, I think I would have to pass on this name. Not a lot of growth, some geopolitical risks, but still a modest price, modest relative valuation. Thanks for the call. Now, we got a lot of ground to cover over the next 45 minutes or so, and here's some of what I have planned, time permitting. My main focus point concerns this question. There are three compelling reasons to avoid market timing. Now, history tells us to benefit from market timing, you need to be consistently right a lot. In fact, in a 1975 research paper, the Nobel Prize-winning economist William Sharpe, if you've ever heard of the Sharpe ratio, he's the man, showed how a market timer must be accurate 74% of the time in order to outperform a passive portfolio at a comparable level of risk. So for this topic, we'll talk about market timing, what it means, talk a little bit about financial analysis and what it means for investors overall. We're also going to touch on something that I wanted to talk about last Friday, and that is EVs. We talk about those a lot on this show, but typically we talk about the cost of the production of electric vehicles, the efficiency of those electric vehicles, if it makes sense to purchase an electric vehicle for various types of drivers. Instead, we're going to talk about the other side of the equation, and that is insuring electric vehicles, because it can be far more expensive than their gas counterparts. We'll also touch on China's currency, which 2 decades ago some believed would rival the dollar. What has borne out in terms of the truth? Where does it stand now versus what a lot of people thought was going to happen by the 2020s? And what does the future look like? Also, should we have time at the end of the show, we'll talk about the Chinese property market and a surprising percentage of debt has been paid down, really a historic percentage. What does that tell us about the Chinese economy and about investment opportunities for the ordinary man in China or for ourselves? And as always, we have some voice bank questions, one on EWW, its ticker is EW, probably a terrible ticker choice in my opinion, and that's the iShares MSCI Mexico ETF, and one on the Union Business Cycle. We also have some questions that came into our InvestTalk YouTube channel on some of our videos. We like to get to those as soon as we can. And of course, we welcome your finance and investment questions live or anytime throughout the show at 888-99-CHART. Now we're heading into a new short break, and on the other side, we will talk about the market performance today and take any questions that come in, hopefully live. If not, we got plenty of voicemails to play. Feel free to give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com.
My question today is about HME Equipment Services, Inc.
And for our podcast subscribers.
If you're willing to take the risk.
InvestTalk.
If you're okay with that risk.
With host and financial advisor Justin Klein.
And that volatility. Go for it.
And co-host and portfolio manager Luke Guerrero.
This company has fallen like a rock. It's down 52%.
InvestTalk.
Ticker symbol THC.
Everybody wants a secure financial future.
Richard, you have a question about TOL?
But getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information.
Wonder what you think of the price of it.
Go to Chris in Maine looking at IEX.
Hey, Justin. I own it. Just seeing what you thought of it.
InvestTalk is made better by listener contributions. So don't forget to call 888-99-CHART. This is InvestTalk with more than 58 million downloads. Luke Guerrero is here now taking your calls live. 888-99-CHART.
Let's talk a little bit about the market today. U.S. stocks were higher in Monday trading, ending just off of their best levels. You know, the afternoon rally kind of erased some of the morning weakness. S&P 500 capped off its 30th record close of the year today. And that's because big tech was the leader with Tesla and Apple, really the two major standouts. Underperformers include managed care, biotech, some utilities, copper, and REITs. Gold was down almost 1%. Crude oil settled up 2.1% after capping its best week since early April last week. Copper finished down 1.1%, making that down 13% from its late May peak. Overall, I'd say not much behind today's risk-on moves. Very few catalysts to start what is expected to be really a quiet week and a short week, as I mentioned. June Empire Manufactured beat as the employment index kind of weakened a little bit, though prices paid and prices received both fell off. Several members of the Fed also said that one cut is appropriate, though differing on whether September or December is when you should expect it. And looking forward, initial claims on Thursday is a expected number. It should get a lot of attention after last week's nine-month high triggered some growth worries. Now, as we round out the quarter, there's also some investor psychology at play because the S&P has been up in July for 9 straight years and the NASDAQ has been up for 16 straight years. Even though it's a quiet week, we'll still be looking forward to, like I said, that employment number on Thursday and retail sales tomorrow. Now, shifting gears, let's answer another question. This one came in from our InvestTalk YouTube channel. I want to remind you that our audio podcast is also available in video form on our YouTube channel. And it seems like every day now we receive finance investment questions through that medium. So here's one that came in yesterday. And the question is about TSCO. It says, I'm looking at buying and holding TSCO and holding it long term. Do you like the company and its long term potential? So let's pull up TSCO. And TSCO is a tractor supply company. So it engages in the retail sale of farm and ranch products. And over the past 5 years, it's been incredibly strong relative to the market. Year to date, it's up 34%. 52-week percentage change is 32%. It is a kind of larger mid-cap company on the large side, $30 billion in terms of its market cap. Its debt levels, about $5 billion, very modest debt levels. It's got a lot of short interest out there right now, about 7%. And its dividend yield has been 1.57% right now. You know, I think talking about the business model before we dig into the fundamentals, I think from a retail type business, their business model is a lot more recession resilient than most other retails, a lot of the discretionary consumer names, because they sell, well, tractors. You know, the dividend has been growing pretty rapidly. If you take a look down here at dividend per share, it was $1.20 back in 2016, $4.12. Yeah, last year projected to be 437. This year, that is also something that we like. Their debt levels, like I said, are pretty modest. Their cash flow has been improving. They've been buying back shares. In 2019, they had 120 million shares outstanding. Now they have about 107 million shares outstanding. Taking a look at their earnings predictions, their earnings have been upgraded pretty consistently over the past 3 months. We like that as well. Their revenue growth, pretty solid. They were doing about $8 billion in sales in 2018. Now they're doing 14.5 as the most recent fiscal end, projected to be almost $15 billion in sales this year. All the while, their net margin has been pretty consistent, steadily growing a little bit. 6.7 is where it was 5 years ago. Now it's sitting at 7.6. Return on assets, return on equity all look pretty solid to me, frankly. So let's take a look at their relative valuation, because again, I say it all the time, it's not just about buying good companies. It's about buying good companies for fair prices. And take a look at their forward-looking price to earnings, 25.8. It's kind of high, you know, with consistent growth of around 7 to 10% year over year is a low, averaging out to about 13%. It's not too crazy, but it is still well above their five-year average of 21.7. Their price to book, that number is a little higher, in my opinion, 14.2 relative to their five-year average of 11. Price to cash flow at 20 times. Price to sales still at about a modest 2. Now, you're getting a mixed picture here from these valuation numbers. I love the growth. I like that it's a low debt business. I like they've been buying back shares. I love the cash flow numbers. All that looks fantastic to me. But I still think that this is, you'd be paying a pretty high premium for a business that the long-term growth rate is certainly lower than the five-year annualized growth rate over the past 5 years. It has good earnings potential, good growth potential. I certainly think you should keep it on your watch list. Again, it's more of a recession-proof business than some of those other retail names, which is great. And so with its kind of strong growth prospects and its market dominance, I think it's a good name to add to your portfolio. But I would wait for that relative valuation, particularly that price earnings, to come back down towards its five-year average, closer to about 20 times, I think, sounds better for this name. Thanks for watching. Now we're headed into a short break now, and still to come, more answers to your caller questions and our focus point and some interesting information I learned today about China. Feel free to give us a call right now or anytime at 888-99-CHART.
You've got finance and investment questions, and Luke Guerrero is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Looks like I have the pleasure of speaking to Jeffrey from Alabama, who has a question about Maine. Do you own it, or are you looking to buy it?
I'm looking to take a position in it.
Okay, well, let's take a look at it. And for those who are listening, that ticker is Maine. He is not talking about the state of Maine. And that is a Maine Street Capital Corporation, which is an investment firm. And they do long-term debt and equity capital financing to middle market companies. So taking a look at this name, they are a $4 billion name, so small cap name, got quite a bit of debt, about $2 billion, but their interest coverage ratio is 5, so they're not overly levered. That's good. Good news. Got no cash on their balance sheet, which is kind of surprising to me for a debt and equity financing company, but we'll move past that. Their cash flow, improving. It's great, up from $200 million 2 years ago to about $350, $400 million. Profitability looks to be improving. They got some short interest out there and a high dividend yield at about 6%, which it looks like that's been pretty consistent over time. You know, they've underperformed their industry by about 11% annualized over the past 5 years, and I wonder if that's artificially boosting their dividend yield. Let's take a look at their dividend per share. So 2.3 back in 2018, and that's been consistently improving, which is good. 276 this year, supposed to be 370 this upcoming year. So here's two reasons why, even though they are up 15% year to date, I am a little hesitant. Number one is they are a serial issue of shares. They've gone from 60 million shares outstanding in 2019 to 85 million shares outstanding. The reason why they have modest debt levels is probably because they keep issuing shares to capitalize their company. The relative strength has been pretty consistent over the past 5 years, but weaker than the market. As I mentioned, they've underperformed their industry consistently. They've underperformed the index, the S&P 500, consistently. Their margins are all over the place. You know, for me, I think that a company that is working to primarily capitalize, recapitalize, do buyouts, growth financing, acquisitions is the most cyclical of cyclical companies. And so I see a lot of potential risk on the horizon for a company that, although they don't have a lot of debt, they are a variable business. And so the dividend yield is concerning to me. The underperformance relative to the industry is concerning to me. And the just all over the place profitability is concerning to me. I don't think it's a terrible company. I just think that there are better uses of your capital that on a risk-adjusted basis, you probably can do better, especially, as I mentioned, given that it has a consistent underperformance to the industry, though it has had certainly a good year that's making up for several bad years. I think the market's probably discounting the variability of the business here. Thanks for the call. Now, my main focus point today concerns this story. There are three compelling reasons to avoid market timing. History has told us that to benefit from market timing, you need to consistently be right. In fact, in a 1975 research paper, William Sharp showed how a market timer must be accurate 74% of the time in order to outperform a passive portfolio at a comparable level of risk. So I think let's start by talking about human psychology, because throughout our investing lives, we often face temptations that can lead to irrational decisions. Maybe we see an article on Facebook or through social media that's misleading or makes us want to do something with our money. Or perhaps there's a persistent sense of impending doom that makes us unreasonably bearish. Or even the guarantee of riches, which makes us invest in some unseemly and ill-advised businesses. That we all know about. Besides all this, there's one thing that perhaps all of us fall prey to at times, and that is market timing. Now, the allure of timing the market is particularly strong. Why? Well, we might feel compelled to act when pundits declare it's a good or bad time to invest. But empirically, we know that consistently successful market timing is highly challenging and often very unprofitable. William Sharp's research, as I mentioned, indicated that a market timer needs to be correct 74% of the time to outperform a passive portfolio, a feat nearly impossible to achieve consistently. Even if one manages to time the market successfully, the overall benefit to investment returns is minimal. Peter Lynch illustrated that perfect timing over 30 years yielded only slightly better results than simple annual investments. So, instead of trying to time the market, you should have time in the market. Charles Schwab's research suggested that investing promptly at the beginning of each year or adopting a dollar cost averaging approach generally leads to favorable long-term outcomes. This strategy proves even more reliable than attempting to predict market highs and market lows, which is not only fraught with risk, but also adds stress and likely yields a minimal additional benefit. Staying invested without trying to time the market is usually the most effective approach. Remember, market prices are generally efficient. They generally price assets relatively fairly over the long run based on all available information. And that's not to say there's not short-term inefficiencies in the market. There certainly can be, and they happen all the time. Look at GameStop, the definition of market inefficiency. But overall, investing in good businesses for the long run provides the chance for higher expected returns. I'll say it once again, time in the market beats timing the market. Now, on the next Invest Talk, we'll look into the story behind this headline. It's been a terrible time for bonds, but should you own them now? Challenges in the bond market could set the table for stronger future returns. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and we are ready to take your calls live at 888-99-CHART.
Luke Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
I wanted to pick your brain about Apple. What did you think about their earnings call? Is this a good time to add to my position?
Call InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It is official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Let's say you've been thinking about learning a new language. Okay, why? I mean, how would it come in handy? And where would you want to use it? Could it be that you have an upcoming international trip? Or maybe you want to connect with family members or friends from a different culture? I think you should know about Rosetta Stone. With millions of users, it's been the world's most trusted language learning program for 30 years. Rosetta Stone is available on your desktop or as an app with audio companion and the ability to download lessons offline. Rosetta Stone truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. It has a built-in, patented speech recognition engine called True Accent. So as you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you pronounce words. With Rosetta Stone, you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's an intuitive process designed for long-term retention. You really learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. Rosetta Stone is an amazing value, so your special skill set is within easy reach. You know you want to do this, so don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, InvestTalk listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off now at rosettastone.com/today.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. How they get there and when they get there, that depends on many factors. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
So to Carl in Menlo Park, who has a question about SIM, S-Y-M. Do you own it or are you looking to buy it?
I'm looking to buy it. I was just wondering what your thoughts on it were.
Yeah, well, you know, keep going.
I was figuring that warehousing is going in that direction. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they just turned a profit this last quarter.
Yeah, so taking a look at SIM, for those of you at home or listening anywhere, is an automation technology company where essentially what they're trying to do is they create automation systems that save on labor and space for distribution warehouse centers. And so I actually remember reading about this company back in January and hearing about they had a huge, huge backlog of orders that was set to make revenue take off. And keeping that in mind... year to date, they're down about 33%. Taking a look at their sales growth, it seems pretty strong, but their net margins from an annualized basis are still negative. Looking at June of 2024, it looks like they did turn a profit, but they still have a lot of room to catch up here. Looking at cash flow, still pretty modest. Their debt levels, non-existent. They got $14 billion in debt. They have about $446 million cash on hand on a $3.6 million small cap company. The short interest out there, even though the price has fallen 33%, short interest out there still sits at 23%. A lot of short interest. I think this company certainly does have a future. I like the idea. I like automation going into, you know, saving labor spaces, dealing with the overhead issue of warehousing and distribution centers, especially in a time where a lot of purchasing and a lot of goods are moved online, right? Rather than at brick and mortar stores. But for me, I think even for those of you who can see at home here, there's not a lot of history for me to judge this on. And so sometimes when you invest in companies that are new companies that don't have a lot of history, you can certainly win. But it's, for me, it's a little bit too risky for my blood. Its price to earnings, even with what's been going on, is still at 83 times. So I think they're banking on a lot of growth. Also, another thing to think about is you should never really catch something in a downtrend right here. This has been in a consistent downtrend since really November, even with the expected growth out in January. It kind of peaked out a little bit, then started to trend downward. It's broken through some support, so it's trying to find some now. So maybe I would keep this on my watch list. It's an interesting idea. The backlog is something that interested me, like I said, back in January, but that certainly hasn't borne itself out yet, not only within the financials, but with how it's been performing. So for now, I would pass. Thanks for the call.
All right.
Now let's keep it moving. Go back to the InvestTalk voice bank for a question that came in earlier. You know the number, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Luke or Justin. Jake here from North Carolina. Just had a question about your investment philosophy overall and how you apply that to your clients' investment accounts. The firm that I work for uses the business cycle as our framework for when to buy, when to sell, what to buy, what to sell. But I was just curious as to the degree of which you use the business cycle to inform you of your investment decisions in your managed client accounts or otherwise. Thank you very much. Looking forward to hearing on the show.
Yeah, that's a great question about how to use the idea of the business cycle to inform your allocation decisions. And so I always try and stress that portfolio management generally is a holistic thing, right? It shouldn't just rely on any one factor, because where we are in the business cycle is certainly something that's open to interpretation from different market participants. Recall, we should have had a recession a while ago. And so the way we like to think about it is not just where we believe we are in the business cycle and how that should change our sector allocations, but what's the market doing? And how do we look at how the market is interpreting where we are cyclically? Well, we know names that tend to perform well in different areas of the business cycle. We know names that tend to perform poorly. So looking at how the market in terms of its momentum prices things, right? A great proxy, Russell 3000, looking at the entire U.S. market. What percentage of those names are down momentum names? Which ones are lagging the market? Which ones are doing well? What does that tell us about where we are in the business cycle? How should that inform us on how we should allocate across sectors? Should we trim? Should we buy more? How have the movements of the securities within our clients' portfolios changed those sector weightings? So keeping all of that in mind, the business cycle is certainly one piece of it. And for us, it's more than just about what we think. It's about what the market thinks overall and how that can inform our investment decisions. Thanks for the call. Now let's keep moving and go back to the... Oh, we don't have that. We're going to actually shift gears and talk about electric vehicles. And so, as I mentioned before, this time it's not about the cars themselves, but really about the insuring those cars. And so electric vehicles present a pretty unique challenge for insurance companies. Why? Well, they're generally more expensive than their internal combustion engine counterparts. They also cost more to repair, leading to higher insurance premiums. In the first quarter alone, the average repair claim for an EV was nearly 30% higher than for those internal combustion engine vehicles. The increased cost stems in part from the complex work involved in repairing EVs. Remember, a lot of these are new, and so a lot of mechanics don't know how or don't have the expertise that they may have for internal combustion engine vehicles. For example, you have to de-energize and even remove batteries before you can even start to operate on these things, or else it's dangerous. Insurers also consider the behavioral changes driving EVs might induce. Electric engines accelerate faster. That's just a fact. They accelerate faster. And so what does that mean for how people are going to drive their cars? It could potentially lead to more accidents. And so the industry is, as a whole, still trying to adjust to these realities. So if you take a look at the combined ratio, which measures underwriting profitability, where a figure above 100 means a loss, it's been over 100 for EV policies in both the US and China, which really just underscores some of those challenges I was talking about. Despite these hurdles, the EV market still continues to grow. Global sales are expected to increase by 20% this year. Some insurers are responding by offering discounts for EVs, perhaps seeing an opportunity to enhance their brand presence as being the insurance company for electric vehicles in a burgeoning market. But repairability issues are persisting, and there's a push for better collaboration between car makers and insurers to improve the situation. But there's a caveat here. New innovations, Tesla's Giga Casting, uses larger casting parts, could potentially even increase repair costs, despite lowering production costs. You have to think about the cost of owning a car just like the cost of owning a home, right? It's repairs. It's the whole cost of owning. It's not just the purchase price. It's not just the sticker price. The integration of digital technology in vehicles offers some hope. It can provide detailed driver data that could help insurers manage risks more effectively. Companies like Ford are exploring ways to use this data to offer discounts and encourage safe driving behavior. Yet, despite these potential advancements, the reality of high repair costs and complex insurance claims remains a pretty significant barrier to lowering EV insurance costs. And so as the market for EVs grows and evolves, both insurers and car makers will need to find more effective solutions to all of these challenges. Now let's shift gears back and talk about another question that came in from our YouTube channel, this one on KHC. Can y'all do a review on KHC, Kraft Heinz? Certainly we can. And so for all of you who aren't aware, though certainly being a kid growing up in this country, Kraft Heinz was a staple of my household. They are a food and beverage products brand. And so they have a lot of famous brands, which is something that certainly is beneficial for them in terms of their investing or investability, if you will. Because a lot of these brands are household names. And so overall, it looks like they've kind of had softer volume trends and had to increase prices a little bit. If you take a look at this chart here, it's been a pretty bleak 5 years in terms of relative strength. They've underperformed the S&P 500 by about 17%, the industry by about 8%. Their sales growth, pretty much non-existent. Back in 2018, they did $26 billion in sales. At 26.2. This year they did 26.6. They're projected to do 26.7 this upcoming fiscal year end. Their margins have been improving, certainly. They actually lost money in 2018, and it's been steadily improving from about 1% to 6%, 10% net margin this year. 13% is what it's projected to be next year. So even though there hasn't been as much revenue growth, they've certainly been reducing costs. Another thing that may be compelling to you, 4.9% dividend yield, which has been pretty consistent, right? About 5.8, anywhere from about 4 to 6% over the past 5 years. Dividends per share, very consistent since dropping off actually from 2018 to 2019. Remember, we say all the time, dividends are not set in stone. They can be reduced. And certainly there was a reduction in the dividend here from $2.50 to $1.60. Now, they've been buying back shares a little bit over the past year, but nothing to go crazy about. And cash flow seems to be taking a turn here. So they've improved their cash flow. They've been improving their profitability. You know, this is a story of a company that has a lot of debt, $20 billion on about a $40 billion market cap company, though a lot of that's pushed out like some of these big businesses have done. And I like that their earnings are improving. They've been getting consistent earnings upgrades for about the past 8 months now, their cash flow, their profitability, even though that revenue growth isn't quite there, they're reducing production costs. And it's sitting at a pretty relative or a pretty modest relative valuation, 10 times forward-looking earnings, less than a dollar, less than one in its price to book. It's actually priced lower than the book value of its assets. Its price to sales is 1.5. I'm a little interested here. I'm pretty interested. And it's been sitting around the 32 to 38 range for the past year. You know, this is one of those businesses that has a very well-known brand. They've been reducing debt in recent years. They actually had $30 billion in 2019. They've brought it back down to $20 billion, buying back shares a little bit, a consistent dividend. Even though they cut 5 years ago, they're starting to right the ship, which is great. You know, they got Philadelphia, they got Cool Whip, Jell-O, many other brands. I like it. I actually like it at this price. So yeah, I would give it a thumbs up. I don't know if you'll see any explosive movement here, but it seems to be at least the company is moving in the right direction. That's something I like. Now, we thank you for the many fresh voice bank questions. As you know, Justin and I are happy to answer your live calls or recorded questions. So let's play one right now.
Hey, Justin and Luke. Bill from Philadelphia here. I just wanted to get an opinion from you guys. Is there ever a time I'd want to go 100% into bonds and treasuries? For example, scenario, 65 years old, collecting Social Security, have, you know, say $2 million in the bank, want to just put that all into bonds and treasuries that pay the yield and pay living expenses, and then maybe a little cash at the end of the month savings to spend on whatever. Just wanted to get your thoughts, if there's ever a scenario for that, or if you guys completely disagree with ever doing that and diversify it more into stocks and bonds and real estate and what have you. Love what you guys do for the show. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Should you ever go 100% in treasuries and bonds? And so I think there's some scenarios where that makes sense. One is if you are the most risk-averse person on planet Earth, right? Another is, what's your investment horizon? If you're towards the end of the end stage of life, and you have invested enough such that you are pretty much perfectly matching your spending needs, then you really can't take on that risk, right? And so at that point, it becomes a liability matching thing. These are the costs that you're going to incur. This is the money that you have. You know, traditionally speaking, the advice is that early on in your life, you start with a large amount of equity, a little bit of fixed income, and then there's a glide path where those tend to switch as you get older. And I think on the average, that's the correct answer. But there's also people that are in different situations, right? It could be the case that you have enough money saved such that you can pay all of your costs for the rest of your life and leave money for your children 10 times over. Now, that person certainly shouldn't be 100% fixed income. But certainly there could be a situation where you don't have a lot of wiggle room and you can't have any risk tolerance. And so does that situation exist? Yes. Is it probably rarer than you'd think? Probably. But again, everybody's investment needs, everybody's risk tolerance levels differ. So if your circumstances require it, certainly it could be the case that 100% bonds or treasuries make sense for you. Thanks for the call. Now, before we head into the break, I want to tease a little bit our next talking point, which is about the Chinese yuan and how a couple decades ago, many people thought that it would rival the dollar. And as is often the case, predictions tend to not bear out as perfectly as the consensus thought. And you have to remember, this was kind of in the wake of the 2007, 2008, 2009 financial crisis. And so you had a situation where the global economy was being dragged down by toxic assets, primarily in U.S. banks, just because those are the biggest banks, but they were everywhere. And because of that, people saw the hegemony of the U.S. dollar as something that could be bad for markets moving forward. So we'll dig into that after we get back from the break. But for now, this is Invest Talk, and I'm Luke Guerrero, and we have one goal here, that is to help you achieve your financial freedom. Our work continues after this break, so get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Everybody wants a secure financial future, but getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information. That means you'll have finance and investment questions. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Before the break, we were talking about how the dollar is dying. No, I'm kidding. Some wish it was, but that's certainly not the case. Month after month, we're seeing increasing usage of the dollar to fund international transactions. And one such country that banked on the dollar losing some of its power was China. Now, recently, Chinese officials are expressing satisfaction with the yuan's progression as a global currency. In fact, according to the governor of China's central bank, the international monetary system is diversifying rapidly. The yuan is actually now the fourth most active currency in global payment and ranks third in trade finance. Approximately half of China's international transactions, including those for financial assets and goods, are actually settled in yuan. However, as I mentioned before, the yuan's global influence remains pretty limited compared to its earlier projections. After the 2007-2009 financial crisis, analysts predicted a significant role for the yuan. Fred Hu of Goldman Sachs envisioned the yuan comprising 15 to 20% of foreign exchange reserves by 2020. Research from the early 2010s highlighted the yuan's increasing significance in East Asia, where many local currencies began to follow the yuan more closely than the dollar. Despite these developments, the yuan faced challenges, weakening against the dollar in 2014 and suffering from a pretty poorly managed devaluation the year after that. And that led to significant capital outflows and tighter capital controls. And so it's still important to note that it is included in the IMF's basket of reserve currencies. They included it in 2016. But how did that 15 to 20% prediction bear out? Well, the yuan's share of global foreign currency reserves at the end of last year was 2.3%, which ranks it sixth behind the Canadian dollar. Now, recent studies indicate the yuan's influence over other East Asian currencies is pretty minimal once adjusted for global financial conditions and even adjusting for commodity price movements. And so while there remains potential for the yuan to fulfill its envisioned global role and possibly even rival the dollar, it seems to me that it must first surpass the influence of currencies like the Canadian dollar. Now let's use the remaining time to squeeze in one more caller question from 888-99-CHART.
Hi guys, love the show. Was wondering if you could take a look at Chegg for me, please. Ticker CHGG. This seems to be one of those stocks that everybody thinks ChatGPT is going to kill. And I think that, in my own opinion, their brand and usefulness is a little more than nothing. And I just wanted to get your opinion. Again, appreciate everything you guys do for us.
Okay, so taking a look at Chegg, It's spelled C-H-E-G-G, but the ticker is C-H-G-G. First thing that strikes me is it's a $285 million market cap company that's run down 77% this year. It now trades at $2.61, and yet there's still 20% short interest out there. So there's a lot of people out there that think this thing is going to, I would say, about zero. And in 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, it lost money. In the past couple years, looks like they had a crazy year in 2022, net margin 34% down to 2.5% next year. Or this upcoming year, it's projected to be about 17.5%. Sales have grown pretty well. 321 back in 2018, up to 716 million last year. It's projected to fall down to 652 million this year. And for those of you who don't know, Chegg is an online platform that helps learning. It's a learning platform. I think I used it when I was in college to help me study. And so they offer e-textbooks, printed textbooks. And it's an older company. It was started in 2005. But now its debt far outweighs its market cap. $618 million worth of debt, which granted they've paid down. They had $1.2 billion in debt last year. It's only at $618 million on a $300 million market cap company. I have to disagree there. I think that for all the hype that AI has had, one of the easiest things a company will be able to do is source within their models a lot of available information and use it to teach people. So I think that although the brand was great for 20 years, the market's telling you don't, and I'm also telling you don't as well. Thanks for the call. Now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and this completes another InvestTalk program. We thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads. Get yours anytime at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Please be sure to review us and rate us on iTunes. I hope you've heard, because we say it all the time, the InvestTalk podcast is also available in video form on our YouTube channel. Search InvestTalk with two T's. Independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.